Wisconsin Eye is at Ronald Reagan High School in Milwaukee, part of MPS. We're talking to four student leaders. They are the leaders of the next generation. They are the voters of the next generation. They are the taxpayers of the next generation. We want to ask them what's on their mind, issues that concern them. But before we hear from the students, thanks everybody. Thanks to MPS and Ronald Reagan for hosting Wisconsin Eye. That Reagan High is in the 7th Assembly District, so we have invited and State Representative Daniel Reamer, who represents the 7th Assembly District. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, and a pleasure to be here with these the best and the brightest, and like you said, the future leaders in the state of Wisconsin. And a pleasure to represent the school and the students here. 10 years ago, I was where these students are right now, about to graduate from high school and on the cusp of making the big decisions in life, where to go to college and what to do next after that. So it's exciting to be here with them all and to hear what they have to say about the big issues facing this state and what they're going to do to address those big issues now and in the future.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to ask each of the students to give me their name, their year in school, what they hope to be doing, where they want to be working, where they'd like to be working in 10 years. And then you were asked to think about really the major issues that concern you, so you could list one or two. Please.
My name is Wanye Frazier. I'm a senior. In 10 years, my goal is to have my own dance studio, self-owned, self-founded, and to work with some other nonprofit organizations to further dance awareness and body awareness and just community awareness within the community.
Thank you. And the issue that?
Well, as I said before, a lot of the issues that I see are community-based, and I really want to focus on community awareness and building a unity between all factions of community, all creeds, all backgrounds within a community field and a community basis.
Thank you.
My name is Patrick McClendon. I'm also a senior at Ronald Reagan High School. 10 years from now, I'd like to be graduating, finishing my residency after medical school. That's the plan anyways. And I suppose an issue that I find either the most alarming or most important would be the impending proposed budget and the way in which it's treating education, and I suppose the way in which our state and the country is handling education these days.
Thank you, Patrick. Please.
My name is Paola Gonzalez. I am a sophomore at Ronald Reagan High School. 10 years from now, hopefully I'll be going for my master's. I would really like to pursue law, so that's really something that I'll be looking forward to. And right now the issue that I'm most concerned about would probably be anything that revolves around education. There's been a lot of budget cuts going on that will really affect my life along with the students around here in our school.
My name is Rafael Diaz. I'm also a sophomore at Ronald Reagan. In 10 years, I hope to also be a lawyer. But mostly what I like, the biggest issue that impacts me is definitely defending our public educations as a whole, not only in the state of, like in Milwaukee, but as a whole, as Wisconsin, because public education is definitely the way to go.
Okay, let's start. Three of you mentioned public schools and public education. You said it's under attack. Do you want to elaborate, please, Rafael?
Yeah, there's been certain bills proposed to the state government, either AB1 and the Darling Bill, which will pretty much put failing schools, and I say failing because of the way that due to things like not having a big budget or something like that, are putting these schools in some tough situations where they don't have enough teachers, or they don't have enough desks for students, or they don't have up to quality books, and they put these schools, these failing schools, on a track to privatization, which they'll be sold. The students in those would be carried over, and the money that each student is, the government gives to each student, will go to a private company and a private corporation, and maybe for profit or just for the money. They don't really care about the students sometimes. And then this is one of the ways that that's what I see is under attack. They're taking away our schools, they're taking away our students, they're taking away our resources to learn and giving them to people who just bought their way into it.
Okay, the Parents' Choice program in Milwaukee is 25 years old this year. So you don't like that program? Fair summary, Rafael?
When we expanded it, I think the issue is becoming that choice funding and programming is being, like, we see an increase in the way in which taxpayer money is going towards choice programming, And choice programming is specifically oriented around private and parochial schools. And I think that the issue that we see is that those schools are meant to be funded by, tuition-based, things that in which those families, in a lot of ways, pay their way into private or parochial schools rather than going into the public school system. And when we see our, taxpayer dollars moving away from public education and towards private education, I think it's just interesting because it seems as though we're supporting students who, stereotypically can afford to go to private schools versus, or would, rather go to private schools than public schools, which shows that we're no longer supporting our, our public education program or our public social programs, rather than moving, and then moving towards that private tract. And so then we move towards this privatization of education, and there's tons of arguments, against that, and the way in which it limits public education and other things.
Before I get the representative's perspective, you also talked about public schools. Do you want to elaborate on why it's a major concern?
Well, first of all, I've been in public school ever since I was four. So it's definitely something that my family and has agreed upon. I feel like it's kind of not, like a lot of students who can't afford private schools, they decide to go to private schools because they think that it's better education. However, that's not really the case. If you come to a public school, you get equally, or if not even more, knowledge than you do when going to a private school. Sometimes teachers in private schools don't even have to get a degree in order to become a teacher. So that's definitely a concern of mine, because I do have other family members that do go to private schools, and they're not able to have the equal amount of resources as I am. So.
What we hear in the Capitol is that this is a parent's choice issue, that parents should have the right to try to put their kid in a private school, depending on the individual needs of that student. You heard that argument.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to put in some? here's some of the context. Sure. The governor's budget would cut $127 million from aid to public schools. Okay, so I'm just filling in some context. Mm-hmm. And there are legislators in the Capitol that would like to restore that. Also, I just got this number on the way here. The average spending per student at Milwaukee Public School is $14,263. The average statewide spending, my source on this is the Fiscal Bureau, Daniel, mm-hmm. is $12,700. So MPS spends an average of 12% more than students statewide. But let's talk about the choice from the
sure.
perspective of the Capitol, Daniel.
Sure. Well, I think what the students here are expressing is shared by a lot of folks, concern shared by a lot of folks around the state. The Marquette University Law School, through Charles Franklin, issued a poll recently saying that 78% of the registered voters in the state of Wisconsin, according to this poll, were opposed to the $127 million cuts to public education. And I think that is part of the context within which the concern about the expansion of the choice, the voucher program, fits into that to that kind of poll. I think you see a number of people concerned that public schools will suffer if we divert money from one system toward another. I think the argument about letting parents make a choice for their kids is one that certainly had some strength. It's why Milwaukee instituted that program in the first place, and there are some schools that function effectively under that program, but there are others that are really not serving the needs of students effectively. They're not held accountable through any system that we would recognize as accountable to the voters and the taxpayers of the state of Wisconsin, and so some, myself included, are concerned that money isn't being spent as effectively as it could be. In response to your numbers about comparing the numbers of the amount that it costs to educate a student at MPS compared to an average student somewhere else, compared to perhaps even an average student at a voucher school, I think it's always important to dig deeply into those numbers. If Bill Gates walks in the room right now, the average income of everyone here goes up by a huge amount. So sometimes averages can disguise aspects of any numbers. For instance, my mom is an MPS speech and language pathologist, so she works with students who have disabilities, pretty severe cognitive setbacks, and they cost more to educate. Voucher schools often don't have the ability to work with kids with learning disabilities, and for that reason, they don't They don't need to spend as much per pupil to do so. So I think those are some of the broader concerns that, that folks have, and it doesn't surprise me that a lot of people in the state of Wisconsin are concerned about those big cuts and that the students here would be concerned about those cuts too.
And a quick follow-up question on this issue. Do you know some of your neighbors or friends who are attending private schools under the CHOICE program? And are they doing pretty well vis-a-vis you attending a public school at MPS? Anybody?
Well, I have a cousin, actually, who attended private school. And it's always funny. He's a year younger than me. And we always will code talk about homework, or else he'll tell me what he's working on during his classes. And what I realized, especially being here, is that I was almost 2 years ahead in math than what he was learning his junior year. My classes were more advanced, my literature classes were more advanced, my history classes were more advanced. I was ahead of him, and I was at least 2 or 3 years ahead of him in terms of knowledge or math base than he was, and he was only a year younger than me. So I noticed there was a distinct difference in terms of education, and in terms of awareness. He's not aware, I'll say, of a lot of public issues, he's not very good when it comes to dealing with people from other cultural backgrounds, or he's very secluded in that sense. But I understand why his parents did it. And I've been in MPS my entire life as well. And everyone has different experiences. Everyone has a different experience with MPS. And I've been very fortunate to have gone to very good schools. I come from Golden Meier, from Golden Meier went directly into Ronald Reagan, so I've had a very good school experience at excellent schools. But everyone isn't given that opportunity. And so in that sense, I understand why some kids are given sent to private schools, because they feel as if that some MPS schools can't provide the proper education needed, the proper resources, and that's definitely a factor that's to be considered.
Anybody else? Do you know somebody who's going to a CHOICE school in his or her experience? If not? No?
I've known a few people out of Mesmer, and a great deal of their population is able to attend Mesmer through CHOICE funding. I can't give a specific reference, but I can't really give a reference towards their educational attainment either. So,
because here's my next question, and it stays on this general issue. You're going to Ronald Reagan High, which is nationally known, and do you have to win a lottery to go here? I mean, is it basically that?
It's a little bit more complex than a lottery, I suppose.
Okay.
From what we know, and of course it's changing, I believe, recently.
Yes.
With the way in which we're able to, I don't want to say deny, but the way in which we're able to be a little bit more selective about who we admit. And I think that I know that our process involved letters of recommendation and our transcripts and our admission testing process. And of course that's all changing. But
here's my question. Not every high school in MPS has the programs that Ronald Reagan High School does. So here's my question. If you could wave a wand, what general improvements would you make in all MPS high schools? What additional changes? Thoughts?
Infrastructure.
Please, elaborate.
A lot of schools are disorganized, especially there's a gap between district enforcement and different district involvement in the actual schools. There's a gap there, and there's a communication gap, there's a monetary gap, there's a lot of things that aren't accounted for, and in a lot of schools that can just be haphazard, random, and so everyone isn't held to the same standards. And there are always factors that you can't really consider when every school's going to be different, it's going to be serving a different need for students, but there should be some level of standardization that everyone has to, there are certain criteria that they have to meet, and A lot of these schools aren't receiving the proper enforcement, or aren't even receiving the necessary help that they need to effectively help their students, or to effectively teach their students.
Follow-up question: is it a matter of money? If you could wave a wand, would you just pour more money into these high schools?
Well, I think it's necessary to do.
Yeah.
A lot of schools they get their money from the neighborhood they're located in. I personally live on Milwaukee South Side. My neighborhood school is South Division. And I'm being completely honest, it's not the best neighborhood to live in. It doesn't have the highest property tax, considering a school like Ronald Reagan and the community that we're in. It's a completely different atmosphere. It's a completely different environment that it's in. And when we look at the schools like South Division or Bayview or Hamilton, maybe even, like we look at the students there and we look at, and it's easy to say that they're failing or that they just don't want to be there. But really, it's who has failed them. The school has failed them or the system has failed them. Yes, they have very outdated books and they have like oversized classrooms and enough teachers that want to teach there. And it's because of the reason that the funding is not there to have like more desk or even just put like better qualified teachers and things like that. It's definitely an issue about money. If it's not about money, then why aren't our schools being put up to the highest standard? Why are suburban schools much better than inner city schools? Like, if it's not about money, then I don't know what it is about.
Well,
it's perpetuated by a culture of poverty that our country has sort of perpetuated for a long, long time, and it's that education is no longer and hasn't been valued in many ways within inner city communities because that educational attainment wasn't. I mean, it's not the same. It's not the same in the inner city that it is in the suburbs, and the money that we see is more located, you know, in the suburbs. And when you've got, you know, families that have more money, parents that value education, bring their children up to value education, you get schools that traditionally perform better than inner city schools do. And then it feeds into property taxes. When we talk about the amount of money that's being spent per student in MPS, you have to think about our needs. I mean, we have over, 300 elementary schools? How many of those elementary schools actually have, you know, buildings in which their kids want to come to every single day? You know, there's kids that go to Vincent High School on the north side of Milwaukee, South Division on the south side, another one would be North Division on the north side of Milwaukee as well, and all of those schools they're absolutely falling apart. And when you compare them to the facilities that you have at any number of suburban high schools, I mean, money, you want to talk money, I mean, I think you have to think about how much money is being spent per kid when the amount of money that's being spent per kid in MPS is going to, say, improving buildings rather than improving our textbooks or things like that, because you've got private donors or property taxes that allot for their buildings, which is a huge, you know, expenditure for our district in particular. But going back to the culture of poverty, there's no way in which we can expect the students of Milwaukee in particular to do better when we're not doing things to support their families to allow them to focus on things like education when they're worried about how they're getting home, how they're going to feed themselves at night, whether or not their parents are going to be home because they're working second or third shift, and those are different issues altogether, I suppose.
Please, no, you've been too quiet, so please contribute.
Also, like, whether we like it or not, the money does affect the performance of a student. So a student who has more resources than a student who doesn't does perform a lot better. And sometimes these schools are looked down upon because their students aren't performing as high as like Reagan or Rufus King, but it's because those schools aren't necessarily getting enough resources as Reagan or Rufus King in order for them to perform better. So I think that's what a major component is a part too.
However, I think that I
fully... You guys are great, by the way. Yeah. Go ahead, let it roll.
I fully agree that some schools and schools overall do need more funding. I will agree with that. However, I don't think the solution is giving people more money. Because in any job, in any career, you're taught skills, and you use those skills to further yourself. Training. All of these things, you acquire skills and you use them. However, in this case, a lot of times these schools are thrown, there's money thrown at them. And they have this money, but they don't know how to properly use it. They don't know how to use it for the proper programs. They don't have the proper programs that designated for these kids to get this money, or we're going to funnel this money towards improving the school. We're going to funnel this money towards textbooks. We're going to funnel. There's not that accountability that requires schools that receive this money to use it correctly, to use it properly. And I think that's when it comes down to personnel. It comes down to who we have in charge of programs, who we have holding people accountable for it. Because if we're constantly throwing money all over the place, and I think that has been a constant thing in America, is we believe we can throw money at things, mm-hmm. and money is the fix-all. And so we toss money at things, and we toss money at programs, but we don't make sure that the money is used properly. We don't provide guidance for how the money should be used. We don't provide a clear path where the money can go. And I think that has to be done for MPS, or else it's a waste of time.
Before we turn into another major subject that just came up, the culture of poverty, I want the view from the Capitol. Daniel, when you talk about the unique needs of MPS, do outstate Do your peers from northern Wisconsin, can they relate to that, or did you get the eyes glaze over? Maybe that's over.
Well, I think it's a perfect way to segue, to connect to what I think some of the students have already mentioned and what I think we'll end up talking about next, which is poverty. When you start as a legislator, the Department of Public Instruction and lots of other agencies come to your office, or sometimes you go meet them in a room where they have these tutorials about what the state government does and how they do what they do. And the Department of Public Instruction that works with public schools shows you some charts and some graphs. And one of the charts shows that the number of students in poverty in a school, as that increases, the test scores decrease so that they can match one to the other. And it turns out that legislators from all over the state are actually looking more closely at the connection between poverty and education outcomes and some other life outcomes that are not only affected by education but affected by what is it that poverty does to young brains as they're developing. It turns out it's not even what happens in high school. It's not even what happens in elementary school. A lot of it is happening to developing brains at age 2 or 1 or even in infancy, that the effect of poverty on mothers and fathers and on very, very young children changes the way that their brain grows and makes it harder for these young people to learn as effectively once they hit first, second grade, and even harder when they get to high school, and that can affect their whole life trajectory. So as important as it is to figure out how to effectively put the resources in the right place, and I think that was your point, and other points about how to make the most out of what we spend on schools and students, it's important to recognize that poverty really has an effect on education outcomes. And I do think that legislators around the state from both sides of the aisle understand that, and I think because Milwaukee's a bigger city, and because for that reason it's going to just have a lot more people living in poverty, it's had a bigger effect on MPS. So I think there's a change in the way that legislators are thinking, and I think people from all over the state understand that, because even though they're not as big as Milwaukee, they've got places in their communities that have poverty too, and that have young people that are afflicted by poverty at a young age and that are therefore affected as they become students.
I'm really curious how you four students would, your thoughts on how to attack what you have termed the culture of poverty. Who wants to go first? How would you attack the culture of poverty?
Well,
Wanye, please.
So there are so many factors that influence poverty. And there is no clear-cut path to stopping poverty. There's no one solution fits all. It's impossible. And I think that every city has to find the proper way to individually attack their issue of poverty, because it can vary so much depending on the environment. And the biggest thing is, I don't think, a lot of people say that they need more money or that if you give them money, they'll be able to start off, or they'll have a foundation to build up on. And I think the foundation should come through developing a mindset of success, giving them the idea, the vision of a future.
Can I stop you? Is it the school's duty to give them that mindset of success? Start with the family, because you hear this debate now, the changing nature of the family, so many single parent households. Mm-hmm. Whose responsibility is it to give them that?
Well, I come from a single parent household, and I was raised by my mother. And she early on instilled in me, in my mother's world, nothing is impossible. Anything she sets her mind to, she does. And I've grown up watching that. And so in my household, what my mother does, what my mother thinks she can do, she does. And so I've grown up around that, and that's kind of built a mindset of, I can do whatever I put my mind to. However, students don't always receive that at home, and that's something that we are seeing that's dying in households. It's dying in families. And if you are in a building for 7 to 8 hours a day, most of your time awake is spent in a building with a lot of people who share the same issues, you have different experiences, have there should be no reason why it can't be incorporated into that. And I think that in elementary school, it isn't pushed. And when you get to high school, if you don't already have that drive, if you don't already have that foundation, no matter what programs we install in high schools, you're not going to have a high margin of success. You're not going to have a lot of kids who benefit from this because it's been ingrained in them for at least 15 years.
Okay. Let's hear from some of your fellow students on how to attack the culture of poverty, please.
Well, nobody wants to be in poverty. Nobody wants to not have a job. Nobody wants to just live off welfare. I know people like to say that a lot, right? People like to, especially black and brown people, they like to say that about us. But no, nobody wants to be in poverty for the rest of their life. And if you say it's dying, I don't think it's dying. I think people want to get out the situation that they live in. I do not want to live in the same neighborhood. I don't want, like, if I ever have kids, or I don't want my brothers and sisters to live in the same neighborhood as they do now. It's important. And my parents, they came here. They didn't even go to high school in Mexico. They value education as much as anybody else, and I think they even value it more. And I'm pretty sure nobody wants to stay in the same place they want to now. Everybody wants to learn. That's the important thing. If you give people resources, they will take them and they will use them. People want to work. It's not just that they don't want to, it's just they don't have the resources. You look on the north side, there's practically any jobs. There's very few at this point. On the south side, there's a couple more. But there's primarily not a lot of jobs to take. And the ones you can are minimum paying jobs. And what else are people supposed to do? They'll take those jobs and they'll keep going into the system, and that's the rest. They'll be the rest of their life until it's broken by education. Once again,
So the best way to fight poverty is get someone a job that would allow them to raise their family.
It's not raising the family.
Okay,
it's not about like a job.
With dignity and excuse me. Go ahead.
It's mostly about just education, you know.
Education.
We look at our school systems and we look at specifically the places where I'm talking about now. It's not the best education to get. Yes, I go to Reagan, and it's a very good school, like many other students. But what about the people that don't go here, the people that deserve the same education as I, but they don't get it. And it's not just about having one person raise a whole family. It's about building a community that will raise itself.
Let me correct my statement earlier. When I said that it was dead in the household, I didn't mean the desire to be successful. I think that is very relevant. It's very apparent in society. We all want to get out. I think, and you see that in society because we see the TV and we see the celebrities, and that's the lifestyle we want. Or we want to be successful. We want to have a nice car. We want to have a nice house. We want to be able to go and go on a vacation wherever we want to. That is a dream, that we all have it. However, what's dead is the vision that we can get there, that we can do it. That's gone, and that's not apparent in society. Because what you'll see is, I want to get there. I don't know how. I don't think I can make it. No one in my family's done it. I don't have any examples of it in real life, in my reality. And I think that's the biggest concern.
I'd really love to hear from the other two students on the issue of fighting the culture of poverty. Which of you wants to go first?
Sure. I think the American dream comes up a lot. And the American dream is always like, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You work harder, you have a dream, you fight for it, and you go. But I think the issue that we see with the culture of poverty is that it creates these obstacles that people have to get over, especially minorities, especially those that are already impoverished. And the issue is that, it's really easy, especially for lawmakers, and it's not directly, that comment's not directly at you or other legislators, but it's the idea that our legislative body still exists to be predominantly these middle class to upper middle class individuals who came from white suburban families or from, city families, but they had strong roots. They had a family that already had well-paying jobs. They came home to a family that supported them, that didn't struggle financially. Now, of course, that's not always the case, but that's the predominant case. And so we see that, when we've got individuals that come from a minority background or an impoverished background, and they don't see people of their color, people of their origin, people of their creed in large workplaces, whether it be, right, they don't trust them. They don't see them in education. They don't see them in politics. They don't see them in the healthcare, you know, industry. So we see these, you know, all of these things, all of these dreams, but where do we do see individuals? We see individuals that are celebrities. We see individuals that are athletes. Mm-hmm. And so it's this idea of a get rich quick thing. You know, it's the idea of, well, my American dream is to be rich, and
you don't have the skills to get
there. We don't have the skills to do anything else, and we feel as though the other options aren't options. I don't want to say for us, because it doesn't apply to, it applies far less to me than it does others, but it doesn't apply. That pertains to them.
Patrick, the one thing you would, the one change you'd like made to fight the cultural poverty is what, before I get to you?
I think the way in which we treat poverty. We look at poverty as their fault. We see people that are born into poverty and we see it as their issue. And so we say, look, you've got to work harder. But we see people attacking things like the Affordable Health Care Act that provided necessary help for individuals who can't afford health care. And when you provide people with proper health care, with abilities to go to an educational facility and attend an education, like have value within your educational system, whether it be with increased funding or otherwise. And when you see things like tuition equity and, you know, tuition lowered, we see people view, you know, higher education and the ability to attain things like a job as a politician or otherwise, these higher level jobs, as more feasible because they have the ability to obtain those.
Okay. Thanks for your patience. We've been waiting for your thoughts.
Again, I want to tie back to what Rafa mentioned. I do think that poverty all lines up because of education. A lot of parents do not have a big education background in order for their students, for their kids to, you know, to use as an example. A lot of students, they ask teachers or other mentors, you know, to ask how did they get there. However, like, sometimes those people don't know exactly how to answer, specifically because they don't have the same background as they do. And because of that, it's really tough to just tell to a student, oh, you know, you should really get involved in this and this and this and that. But they don't know exactly what they're going through. At home, they may need to take care of their siblings, or they may need to get a job because they need help out at home. And, you know, you can't just expect to tell a student or anybody else to do these things to improve themselves when you don't know what they're going through, you know. So I think basically what we need to do is just, like, make sure that we build a strong relationship with the students or with anybody in general in order to make sure what their necessities are as a whole, and not just insinuate that they need to do these certain things in order to improve themselves and their lifestyle as well.
Daniel, you got us into that. You had some initial thoughts on the culture of poverty. Any follow-up now that you've heard the students?
Yeah, I think what Raphael said is true. It's what I hear from people. Nobody wants to be in poverty, and most people want to work. I've maybe just met a very small number of people who aren't interested in working, and some of them had parents who were millionaires, so they didn't have to work. But most people, most Americans, are interested in working. But I think a lot of what the students talked about here were the serious obstacles that get in the way of that, whether it's education, like Paolo was saying, whether it's the kind of relationship with you have at home. I mean, I think probably most of us here were lucky enough to have parents or people in our family or people in our community who cared about us that pushed us towards doing better in school, even if we didn't go to the very best school in the world. What I think fundamentally it comes down to in the short term is making sure that people have work, have a job, and making sure that if you're working, you're making enough to be a part of the middle class. You may not be super rich right away or ever, but at some point you can sort of build up the kind of security through the work that you do to do the things that middle class people do. You know, make sure their kids have coats and backpacks and food on the table, make sure they can maybe go to the movies sometimes, take a short vacation. Just basic things that allow for the kinds of things that we think of as a part of the American dream. And to do those things at the state level, I would and have supported specific legislation to try to increase the amount of people that increase the amount of income that people who are working are receiving. A large number of the poor are working, so they are doing the right things. They are doing what they can to feed themselves and feed their family through work, but they just don't have the kind of job that puts them above that poverty threshold and into the middle class. So that, for me, includes things like increasing the minimum wage as a bill I've supported. It includes certain kinds of tax cuts for people with very low income, tax credits like the Earned Income Tax Credit, which both Republicans and Democrats have supported in the past and even support currently. Barack Obama supports it. Representative Paul Ryan, Republican from Wisconsin, former vice presidential candidate, supports it. Marco Rubio, Republican senator from Florida, also supports it. There's very few things that you can get those two kinds of political leaders to agree on, but one of them is tax cuts for people who are low income but working. I think the other piece of the puzzle is, how do you connect people to jobs? Because there are a number of people who can't find work. And I think in the long term, you do need to make sure that the education they receive fulfills the needs of their working career, that they have the skills and the skill sets to be an effective part of the economy. In the short run, I think there are ways to help those that have particular barriers, including people who've been unemployed for long periods of time. Some people get out of prison or jail and can't find work right away. And one of the things that sends you back to prison fastest is, even if you don't break a new law, is not having a job. So some of the programs that Republicans and Democrats have supported include programs like the Transitional Jobs Program, which puts people to work for 6 months at a time. A lot of those folks end up finding work in the private market. A lot of folks who do that and had a criminal record don't go back to jail. So I think effective ways to do this are out there. They have the support of both parties. It's just a question of, are we going to support them in the future?
Get them enacted. Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn to another subject. It was important to Wisconsin High that we not tell you students what issues you most care about. But we really wanted to hear about you. So let's turn to another issue you identified, and I'm going to lump it all together. Violence in the city, police violence, community relations. Okay, who wants to open that discussion?
I can start on this one. With Walker's new proposed budget, we see more money being allocated to building more prisons and institutions that lock our people up, instead of building, like we spoke earlier, we talked about having more money allocated to the public school system in Wisconsin, which that money, it's $127 million, right, that's being cut from the 2015-2017 budget that Walker proposed. And then moving that in having a majority of the money, and a lot of new money going into building prisons and things like that. And when you, especially Milwaukee is one of the worst states to be black, and that's just a fact. We know that half of the youth population, the black youth population in Milwaukee, is incarcerated right now. And then we talked about violence in the city. It also goes back to having a lack of jobs, where people have to resort to maybe selling drugs or whatever it might be, because there's no other option to put on food on the table and things like that. And it's a way that not only we keep the same people oppressed by the government, but also that people keep going into this cycle of oppression, and then you go into the cycle of poverty and all these other things that are connected. And yeah, nobody really wants to add to that.
Can I follow up with your Twitter tweet this week?
You
put it out there on the internet. The cops in my hood ain't no good. The cops in your hood ain't no good. Can I just ask you to put context to that, please, Rabbi?
Yeah. So we, especially I'm an activist and I'm an organizer, and that's one of the chants we use. We used that around 2 or 3 weeks ago when the police killed Tony Robinson in Madison. And we use that primarily. I personally do not trust the police. I really don't, and that's where that chant comes from. Like, cops in my hood, I don't think they're good. I think they pull over people that look just like me, just because of the fear that they have. I feel like in many other places, people don't trust the police as much because of things like what's happening in Baltimore right now. There's video of a police clearly using excessive force to break someone's spine and then not get indicted. And when things like that happen, they happen here in Milwaukee. Milwaukee is one of the worst, like one of the biggest segregated cities in the world and in the U.S. And when things like that happen, it's hard for people to be able to trust the police and say, you know, I trust you into my home, I trust you into my car or whatever it be. And like, you know, it's hard for people to say that. I tweeted that out because in things like this, in moments like this, in times like this, where there's a clear line between people who are fed up with the oppression and the amount of abuse that we have received from police, and that's one of the things that we use. We will march and we will chant and we will say things like that.
I'd like to hear from each of the students on the issue: violence in the city, police violence, community relations. Who wants to go next?
I'll go. There are three things that I think perpetuate violence in Milwaukee: the lack of hope, anger, and misrepresentation. Coming from, I'm African American. I'm black, and one of the scariest things that I can say that I've seen in my neighborhood is the lack of hope. They don't think they can get out. A lot of us don't think we can get out. We think this is the best we'll ever do. I'm not trying to attack hip-hop or common media, but they think that the biggest and the best thing is to be a rapper. They think that is the epitome of, or a rapper, a basketball player, or a football player. They think that is the epitome of what African-Americans can do. And that's been publicized in the media. I was reading an article, and it shocked me, but this article blamed violence in Milwaukee solely on African Americans, and it said that the media lies and misdirects and pushes this blame away from African Americans and blames it on teenagers, and says that African Americans are the solely responsible for this increase in violence in America. And I'm not attacking that comment, because there are things in said the media, when you hear every night another black family is killed, or another black child is killed, or when you hear things like that on the media every night, it's understandable why people might villainize African Americans. It's understandable why this might be, that this idea might be perpetuated. That doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it correct. It doesn't make it acceptable, but it's understandable. And until this representation is addressed, there can never be change, because if I know that when you look at me, you see a threat, you see danger, when I know that, it's going to make me resent you. And that's the other factor when you come to resentment. African Americans, and especially those that are in my family, they have had very, very rough experiences in life. And that has built this ingrained mistrust of the outside world. That's built this they do not trust the government. They don't trust anyone in the government. They believe that they're all against them, and that really perpetuates this.
And what he said, what Wanya said that I think really resonates with me is the idea of misrepresentation. And we see that, I guess, most contemporarily with Baltimore. There are hundreds of Facebook articles and videos and photos of these protesters doing peaceful protests. And I think what was really interesting was most recently when we saw Wolf Blitzer, who was a host on CNN, argue with a activist on the street. And in a lot of ways, I really agreed with what the activist said, and I can't quote directly, but it was the idea that Wolf was sort of, I guess, assuming that broken windows were somehow worse than a broken spine. And, you know, like, you can replace windows. You can't replace the lives that are cost by police and many other things. But, within this issue, police that destroy lives that didn't need to be. We see that in the way that our media perpetuates the image of minority groups within our country. We also see it within the way in which our police are trained. You know, we get police in Europe that encounter similar circumstances, and those sort of altercations end with them getting, say, shot in the leg and going to a hospital, versus someone who gets shot 8 times and dies, or someone who has their back broken. And we see that there's no consequences for that within our justice system either.
Please.
Yeah. Also, a lot of people think, social media especially, I've seen a lot of posts that they mentioned, and like they're saying that it's all like, why would they do that? It's really hypocritical to what like the police are doing. However, like, what else can they do? Like they can do, they can go out and march and rally, you know, just like everyone. However, that has gotten nothing for them, you know. Like, we've done plenty of rallies here, we've done plenty of things here, but it still continues to happen. Like, especially for the Dante Hamilton, when we were, downtown, we were also doing a rally where he was actually attacked by a police officer. And after that occurred, not so much later, you know, Tony Robinson thing happened in Madison. That really didn't stop it. We do try to do, you know, these peaceful protests, but we're not being listened by anybody else and by the government or by, you know, these police officers. Then what else are we supposed to do? We can't just stay there and sit quiet and see more people being killed.
Today, you did a ride around with some police officers. Yeah. So can you talk about that? Did Baltimore come up, Daniel?
Did some of these urban issues come up? It was, I rode around with the chief of police from the village of West Milwaukee, and it's a smaller community. It's less likely to see exactly the same kind of issues that Milwaukee sees, and they haven't had those kinds of issues that you might see in the big city, but it's a village right next to Milwaukee, and one that's a lot like Milwaukee in a lot of ways. You know, something that the chief said to me was that he was glad that they had cameras in a certain place in their station in one of their holding cells, because an incident came up and it was a way for them to say, here's the evidence, we don't feel that we have anything to hide, we want people to look at this and the outside world to look at what's going on and to judge us as they, you know, based on what they see on the camera, and if we did something wrong, then we should be held accountable for that. And I think that a lot of what has been changing about the nature of the relationship between police and the community is based on new information that we're getting, that there are videos now of acts that the public wouldn't have seen, that there was a man in New York who was choked to death. There was a man
Eric Garner,
who was unarmed in South Carolina, who was running away.
Walter Scott
from a interaction with a police officer and who was fatally wounded. You can't build communities when there's a mistrust between the people that enforce the laws and the community. That leads to a serious breakdown. And that's a serious concern. That's something that I think
the breakdown,
the students have addressed.
The breakdown, however, comes, I think, like you said, like how that officer mentioned, or the chief mentioned, how they want to be held, like, we want to be held accountable, we have video equipment to be held accountable, but we see that our justice system doesn't hold them accountable. And so whether or not they want to be held accountable, or whether or not they have measures in place to hold them accountable, doesn't mean that they do. And when you have these issues where police officers, even if it's public, you know, where you've got security cameras that in which we see these officers doing things that perhaps they shouldn't, or handling things in situations in ways that they shouldn't, they're still not held accountable. And so you've got this mistrust that's perpetuated by a lack of accountability, whether or not there are measures in place to hold them accountable.
And I fully agree with Representative Daniel, but what I think is one of the biggest factors with police and community relations is the fact that there's fear both ways. The police, let me put it like this. The community is transformed from a community into a war zone. And when that happens, you have to have an enemy. Crime is the enemy, but crime has been associated with African Americans, with minorities throughout the entire country. It's been associated with them so much that it's transforming from crime being the enemy to minorities being the enemy, because they're perpetuating it. And I'm not going to lie and say that they're not doing it, because they are. And that's very apparent that there have been an increase in drugs and drugs use in minorities and crimes in minorities. That has been apparent, and I'm not going to say it's not. And I'm not excusing that in any way, shape, or form. However, because of this association, and we're associating crime as the enemy, community as the war zone, when the police come in, they're the soldiers. And they're there to eradicate the enemy. So, they're fearful of the enemy because they know that the enemy has weapons and they might kill them, and that fear makes them act a certain way. They're going to shoot first to kill because they fear for their lives. They're going to be very aggressive. They're going to want to make sure when I knock you down, you do not get up. And that's the kind of, that's where we're seeing it morph, how we're seeing it change, and it's evolving into this constant anger, fear, and mistrust of each other.
And you were going to say?
Oh, I was just going to go back to what Patrick was mentioning, how, like, for the Eric Garner situation, people clearly videotaped what was going on. Everyone saw, everybody knew that the police officer was, in fact, guilty. However, that's not what, you know, that's not what they thought. That they didn't held the police officer accountable for what he did. And clearly it was seen by everyone all over social media. You know, it was even on YouTube. It was in several news reports, and still nothing was done.
Okay, time's getting away. I just have a couple quick questions. Let's stay with this issue here. Here's my question. What message were the protesters and rioters in Baltimore sending? Who was?
We're fed up.
The message is, you've had all these protests for each of these murders that have happened within the last year. You've had protest after protest after protest. And common sense tells you, if something's not working, you have to try something new. Yeah. And if me getting out there and you seeing all these people who have a concern and voicing their concerns peacefully has not worked, then we have to change. We have to do something that shocks your system so much that you're forced to acknowledge us. You're forced to see that we are people. You're forced to see that we will act if nothing happens. And I think that's the message they're trying to send. If you don't do anything, if you don't acknowledge our peaceful protests, we're not going to be peaceful anymore because it's not working.
Yeah. And I think MLK was the one that said, rioting is the voice of the unheard. And there's definitely, like, and we say rioting, right? But what I think of rioting, I think of angry white sports fans just throwing a fit after their team loses. And when a group of minorities starts rioting, or as I say, it's an uprising that's really happening between the community, is they're definitely fed up and we're done taking the abuse from police. Like, Baltimore is notorious for having black murders, and it's by cops, and when things like that happen, last year alone, I think there was like 5. And just at Baltimore alone, and then when you look at as a nation, it's just that numbers keep adding up, the amount of bodies keep adding up, and it's a message of being fed up, and they're done being killed, and they're done acting like everything is okay.
Yeah.
Any other, please.
Also, like, a lot of people may think it's all about perspective, you know, but that's not the case. It's being morally, like, what's the moral here, you know? Like, a lot of people don't realize that they don't want their family members to die, you know? Right. Like, you see a kid, he could be in school, and the next thing you know, his father has been shot just because he was walking down the street, which is what has happened in several cases, you know? And it's crazy to think that people look at them as criminals and think that what they're doing is unreasonable, because what they're doing, they're basically saving their own lives along with the people around theirs. Their community is pretty much going downhill, and they're trying their best to bring it back up. And if one way's not working, you know, they have to try another way.
Well, a quick follow-up question. If you were beaten up or assaulted, or a good friend was beaten up or assaulted, wouldn't you call the police?
Sure.
You would?
Let's say sure.
Okay, even though you're suspicious of how they interact in some incidents, Patrick?
I think that question is aimed towards, do you rely on the police? And it's not that the police don't provide an important service. It's that, unfortunately, the way in which police handle interactions, particularly within minority groups these days, is one where they feel as though the best way to take care of it is to just shoot somebody. And the issues that, like, you know, we've got media misrepresents it. They call these protesters that they're rioting when a few, you know, windows get broken. But when you've got, like, as Rafa referenced, when you've got sports fans, you know, say after the Wisconsin-Kentucky game that were flipping cars over, that didn't get any media attention. And so while we do see that, sure, I would call the police if I were to be assaulted or one of my friends were to be assaulted, the issue doesn't become whether or not the police are an important part of society, but whether or not police whether or not police are handling things the way in which perhaps they should.
Same question. Would you call the police if you were beaten or a good friend beaten? Wanya?
Honestly, it depends. In my own personal experiences, and I understand that there has to be some, you have to give trust to get trust. And in my own personal experiences, I still call the police when there are minor disturbances or major disturbances, or if I were to get robbed or anything like that, I would still contact the police. But that's because I believe that, honestly, I have to put the first step forward. I have to keep and maintain a certain relationship. However, just in my neighborhood in general, when there are shootings, the police are not called.
Why?
Because
quick answer. We're time is slipping away.
Yeah, because because we as a community, as a neighborhood, we don't trust them. We don't trust that it's going to be handled properly. We don't trust that everyone's going to get proper representation within that neighborhood, and we don't trust the services that are going to be provided.
Rafa, same question. Would you're beaten up, a good friend beaten up? Would you call the police?
Well, and like when you said, it also depends like who it was. I'm pretty sure they would not take my statement over somebody who was white. Even if the friend was the one, the guy would just claim like self defense. And as we've seen, that's another police argument. It's like it was my life or his, and the police clearly had the upper hand in that situation. And the police their word was taken over the person who was killed or like severely injured, and it's just like whose word are we trusting here? Like whose word are we taking? Maybe the person has a background or something like that. That's the way that the media will attack it and stuff like that. I know you
What about theft from property? If you had an iPad stolen, if you had a computer stolen, would you call police then?
Is a question to me?
Well, it can be.
I mean,
unless you.
I feel like we've been taught all of our lives to call the police if anything wrong is happening around you.
Okay.
It's like. You know, when you're a kid, you're like, oh, I've always dialed 911, call the police, you know? And sometimes some situations do, do cause for a call to the police. However, others don't. I feel like situations like these, they just happen so frequently that some people just don't really mind as much. But, like, to your previous question, I feel like it's really hard to tell whether to or whether not to because... how Patrick mentioned, the way that police are handling those kinds of situations now isn't really the best way they can. So I think it all depends on how the situation's going because you don't want to, hurt this other individual more than they probably even hurt you, especially by calling the police.
With property, I think that people are less likely to call over property than if someone is shot.
Okay.
Because what we've seen in the skill sets of police officers have changed. The likelihood they're going to get your property back, the likelihood that they're going to pursue this actively is slim. Okay. If there's a murder, now you've got their attention.
Okay.
And I think that's kind of the belief system in a lot of neighborhoods. They're not going to really care if your property's been stolen.
Okay. We have to bring this to a close, but I'm going to let Representative Reamer have the final word. Any impressions on what they just said on police-community relations?
I think...
And then finally, I want you... 10 years ago, you were graduating from Rufus King, so give them advice from someone who isn't that far removed from where they are now.
Sure.
How's that for a broad mandate there, Dan?
Thank you. That's good. Well, I think what the students are speaking to is something that's shared by a lot of people in this country right now, and it's really dangerous that there's a lack of trust. I think that's something that I can fairly summarize is what you guys have talked about with respect to police relations with the community, and none of us here are police officers, so I guess we're all part of that community, and that if there is mistrust between us and them, or even defining it as us and them instead of all of us in one community, there's some real concern our society, our community can really break down. So rebuilding that is difficult. I don't have the answer in the way that I've thought more deeply about education and poverty, in part because I think so many police departments belong to local governments and not to the state.
Okay.
And that makes it hard for the president to swoop in and say, we're going to make all these kinds of changes, because whoever the president is can't really do that in the same way. It is something that depends more on mayors and presidents of cities and villages across the country to make those changes. And to the extent that the state can make some changes that make sense, I hope that I can be a part of that going forward.
And then finally, four very thoughtful students. Give them advice.
Well, they're all incredibly bright.
Yes, they
and
are.
Hardworking. I think they've demonstrated how intelligent they are and how thoughtful they are. I guess my only advice would be to, you know, really seek out different kinds of experiences than the one that you know. The world's a big place. Milwaukee is a great place, but the world offers a lot of new insights that I think are worth exploring. And even though I'm a little bit older than you all, I still do that too. I practice what I preach. I'm hoping to travel as much as I can for the rest of my life and always seek out new experiences, new people, new ideas. Whether it's in school or not, that's the way to go. And law school is not as fun as college, so you guys should definitely go to college and call me when you're thinking about applying to law school.
Wisconsin, I want to thank you four students. You're prepared, very thoughtful. I really appreciate that. Representative Daniel Reamer from the 7th Assembly District, thank you very much. Wisconsin, I would like to continue this dialogue. You know, have you heard there's a presidential election next year? Maybe it'd be interesting to come back and visit with some of you students, your reaction to maybe a presidential debate, if you're willing.
I'd love it.
Okay. Well, actually, to classroom teachers in Wisconsin that are out there, Wisconsin I is interested in coming to your classroom, talking to your students, and have them interact with elected officials and policymakers. So call us at Wisconsin I. Again, thank you so much. Thanks to Reagan High. And we're done. Thank you.